Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society, where we make every endeavor to welcome you no matter where you are on your spiritual journey, no matter your beliefs, no matter your ethnicity, no matter your gender, no matter your sexual preference, you are welcome here. If this is one of your first times here and you would like to introduce yourself, we try not to force you to do that, but there will be a time later on in the service for that. Right now, we encourage you to come more than once because our services are different every week. Sometimes I do the service. I am the minister here, Sandy Ingham. Sometimes people from within our congregation do the service. And sometimes we are very fortunate in having people from outside the immediate congregation do the services, such as the case this morning. These then are the opening words from E.B. White. You have been my friend. That in itself is a tremendous thing. I wove my webs for you because I liked you. After all, what's a life anyway? We're born, we live a little while, we die. A spider's life can't help being something of a mess, with all this trapping and eating flies. By helping you, perhaps I was trying to lift up my life a trifle. Heaven knows anyone's life can stand a little of that. Now it is my pleasure to introduce today's speaker. Before I do that, I would like to say that this program, The Road Home, today, is kind of Aaron Bosch's baby in a way. Aaron, for those of you who might not know, is a member here. And Aaron does a lot, I believe, with your program, Kristen. Aaron is, we're thinking of her today because Aaron is in Denver, I think, yes, awaiting an actual baby. baby has been born. Well, we needed another candle for that. All right, excellent. The Road Home just finished celebrating its 15th anniversary. They began in 1999 as a small shelter, I did not know this, and have expanded their services to now include intensive case management services and housing solutions for homeless families. Our speaker this morning, Kristen Rusinski, has been the executive director at the Road Home for 3 years and has been involved with the agency for over 9 years in different roles. She has been passionate, she says, about social justice issues for as long as she can remember, and truly believes every person, especially every child, deserves a place to call home. Welcome, Kristen.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm going to try to sort of set the stage about family homelessness right here in Dane County and then mix in a little bit of what the Road Home does to sort of combat that. And you'll hear a lot about how everything that we do is a real community response to homelessness. So for instance, the shelter network, which most people are the most familiar with, is a huge partnership with over 50 different congregations. This is one of many. Can I actually quickly see a show of hands of who has volunteered in this? Perfect, thank you from the bottom of my heart and from all the families who don't always get to say thank you. Real quick before, just to kind of set the stage for like the long-term success that we're gonna talk about. Volunteers, unfortunately, you're always seeing the families at the worst spot in their lives, the lowest point in their lives. They're not always exhibiting behaviors that are the most ideal. They're so stressed out. They're in survival mode. They're living minute to minute, hour to hour, day to day. We could all celebrate when then they move into housing, but then the volunteers in shelter just get another family in shelter to replace them, and you guys never really get to see the families once they're in housing. The staff, we're so fortunate to be able to see the goals that they succeed and just what they end up contributing as solid citizens once they have some stability and some support. So I always wish that there was a way for the volunteers to hear more of those stories. Unfortunately, you kind of always see the sad side of things, but many, many, many good things happen to the families, including the children, once they're in housing. So I'm going to try really hard not to just read this presentation. That's boring in my mind, except for the very first slide. It's our mission statement. So the Road Home, Dane County provides opportunities for homeless children and their families to achieve self-determined goals and affordable, stable housing. So like was mentioned earlier, we started as just as a shelter back in 1999, but we kind of quickly realized that as much as shelter is needed, it's only a 90-day, families can only have 90 days in shelter. It's sort of a band-aid fix, whereas affordable housing is really the long-term solution to housing. So that's why a lot of our expansion efforts have been in the housing side of things. So our name actually started as Interfaith Hospitality Network. In 2008, we changed that overall name to the Road Home to encompass more of everything else that we were doing, including the housing section. So that Interfaith Hospitality Network was the perfect name for the shelter because it was this Interfaith Hospitality Network. And so that is still called that, so you'll still hear IHN for the shelter, but the overall agency name changed to the Road Home. Some people I don't think realize that we're the same agency, so I like to give that little history. So we're actually the only agency then that works exclusively with families with children in Dane County. We partner very well with the Salvation Army, the YWCA, many other agencies, but we're the only one that works exclusively with families with children. So we really try to emphasize a lot of that cycle of poverty, the cycle of homelessness, and try to focus a lot of our efforts on that younger population. So we do that through the three things up there, shelter, case management, and housing, and we'll go through those a little bit more toward the end. So again, children, it was beautiful to see all these kids up here this morning. I think when most people think of somebody who's experiencing homelessness, they usually think of a single person on State Street, maybe around the Capitol, maybe 40s, 50s, single man usually. I'm stereotyping here, but this is usually what people think of. People don't usually think of the 5-year-olds, the 6-year-olds, the 7-year-olds. 40% of the children we served last year were under the age of 5. So we're talking about little kids who, I mean, they're a sponge at that age. They're learning, they need to explore and discover the world. And you could almost just see that sometimes the trajectory of their life is set on a bad path if they can't have those basic needs met of shelter and food and stability. So many, many more children and families are homeless than I think most people realize. Go ahead. So just a little picture. Again, I mean, when you see a little 1-year-old in your office taking their first step for the first time because they finally have some continuity and stability in their lives, these are like the small successes that we get to see, and I'm sure some volunteers have seen some of those as well. Causes of homelessness, again, the number one cause is just a lack of affordable housing. Does anybody want to guess what the average 2-bedroom apartment costs in Madison right now?
$1,100.
Yeah, around 1,000. Obviously a lot more sometimes, and you could, on the low end, can get maybe like $850. Most of our parents work, but usually those entry-level jobs making $7 or $8, $9 an hour. So on the high end are bringing in maybe $1,200 a month. So if you have $1,000 for rent and then at least $100 for your utility bills, transportation costs, diapers and wipes and whatever you need for all those little kids, it's simply not affordable. So that's what we're talking about when we say affordable housing. We mean maybe families only have to pay $400 or $500 a month for rent because that's what's affordable to them. So the lack of affordable housing is huge. It's also right now a very, very low vacancy rate in Madison. So it's hovering right around 2%. So there just aren't a lot of vacant apartments, period. And then if they are vacant, they're not affordable. There have also been some recent tenant-landlord changes to our state law that makes things much more pro-landlord than pro-tenant, usually. Yes?
Can I speak with you after?
Sure. I was waiting for that. another common cause is domestic violence. We see that a lot. We typically, in our shelter, in case you have volunteered or are wondering about volunteering, we know that we're actually not the safest place for somebody who's fleeing a domestic violence situation. We're not in one locked facility 24 hours a day. We're very volunteer-based. So it wouldn't be safe for the volunteers or the victim. So we're always trying to screen families in rather than screen people out, but safety is number one, so we're not the best fit for somebody experiencing domestic violence, but it's it's amazing how many people we do see who have experienced that in some point in their lives, maybe years ago, maybe last year, maybe currently, but it's huge. It's a definite issue. And a lot of times it's just a lot of different things coming together. Some people were sharing experiences about family members or themselves in the hospital recently. If you don't have medical insurance, I mean, it's just one thing after another piles up, and soon enough, people are left without homes. So I sort of talked about this already, but I guess this just lays out the numbers a little bit better if you want to take a minute to look at that. So we're talking about families in extreme poverty when they're in the situation when they come to us. Go ahead. So again, talking about just those children and sort of that the effects of homelessness. You guys could read these, and I think the next slide also has some more. But it affects children so much, whether it's, and particularly the mobility issue. So a lot of kids that we see by the time they're in eighth grade have maybe already been in six or seven schools, just bouncing around, living with family here, friends here, maybe a hotel here, and then in their car for a while, and then they could finally get into shelter. They're just constantly bouncing around. And I've read a lot of research on this. Every time a child switches schools, they say it sets them back 6 months. And that's not just academically. It's also like socially, behaviorally, emotionally. They have to meet new friends, get to know the teachers. It's a whole system that just keeps almost exponentially getting worse every time they have to move. This talks about more likely to get sick, more likely to have learning disabilities, fall behind in school. And so our community right now is, ever since the Race to Equity report was released, talks a lot about, you know, reading levels, employment, incarceration rate. I'm glad to see that you guys are involved with Moses. And so again, when you don't have those basic needs met, I mean, you could see they're already falling behind in school, which means they're probably not reading at grade level, which means they're probably not as likely to graduate high school, which means they're probably not as likely to get a decent paying job, more likely to end up in the correction system. I mean, it's, you could almost see the path sometimes, like I said earlier. So we really want to try to get kids as young as we can. These numbers are staggering, and I usually like to try to ask this question, so I told you to jump ahead too early. But so I usually ask, how many students do you think were identified as homeless in the Madison schools? And nobody has ever guessed over. It's, everybody always guesses like 300, 400. Last year it was over 1,300 students. Yep.
What percentage is that?
It's right about 5%. I kept getting asked that, so I finally decided to do the numbers. Obviously, you can see the increase the last couple of years. Some of that is just due to better reporting and catching the kids better. Some of it might be due to an increase. But either way, to think of that many students who don't know where they're going to sleep at night, don't know where they're going to get their next meal, how could they possibly be ready to be learning, you know, be at their biggest potential? Very, very difficult. And mind you, that's 4K through high school. So not even counting the 3-year-olds, 2-year-olds, 1-year-olds. And like I said in the beginning, 40% of the children we worked with last year were under the age of 5. So that number is low, if anything. I need to update that now that we have 2014 numbers. But basically, we serve about 150 families a year. But every single day, we still have to turn away a family who calls a mom or dad or a grandma or grandpa who says, you know, I hear you have an emergency shelter. We need to come in tonight. And when you have to tell them that we have to put them on a, you know, I'm sorry, but we have to put you on a waiting list, I get goosebumps trying to describe what that feeling is like. It's terrible. In a county and country as wealthy as ours, there's no need for kids to be living in cars or in bus shelters. Last month, we knew of a family living in a storage unit. At least, you know, to them, they had a roof over their head and somewhere to go to every night. But and this is happening right here in Dane County in Madison. So then to get back to, so now we'll talk a little bit about those three things that we do to try to help this. Like it was mentioned, you guys partner with Midvale Lutheran. If you're not familiar with the way that our shelter works, families stay at a different host congregation for a week at a time. That's a huge commitment because everything is volunteer-based. So every host congregation gets paired up with a couple of buddy congregations. So you're a buddy congregation to Midvale Lutheran. So together, everything, 3 meals a day, evening activities, 2 volunteers sleep overnight, everything from 5 p.m. overnight to 7 a.m. the next morning is run by the community, by volunteers like you. We literally would not have a shelter without your support. So I can't thank you enough with that. The shelter program just serves about 30 families a year. So most of the families that we serve, again, are through our housing programs, just because affordable housing is the answer. We're trying not to expand shelter so much as our housing programs. So again, this is just all about partnerships, whether it's the faith community or the school district, other agencies, the volunteers, businesses, foundations. We're just really trying to encompass the whole community in what we're doing. Case management is sort of the second thing that we do, and I truly think that this is what makes our families as successful as they do. Case management is sort of a term that gets thrown out there quite a bit, so I like to break it down into like three or four sections. The first is that it's a very professional relationship. So we have 8 case managers. They're all masters. They all have their MSWs, Master in Social Works. they're constantly getting new training, learning the most evidence-based practices so that we really know kind of how to work with this population. So it's very professional. The second thing is that it's very holistic. So housing is always the main goal, to either to get families housing or to help them maintain that housing. But so many other things go along to help that. So whether it's health, mental health, education, employment, you name it, whatever that family's goals are, the case managers are there to help them work on that, because that ultimately all ties back into their housing stability. It's also very flexible because, like I said earlier, a lot of the families work. If they're working 9 to 5, our case managers can't work 9 to 5 because they would never have a chance to meet together. So a lot of early mornings, late evenings, sometimes weekends. It's just a very flexible job. And finally, it's very client-centered. So we truly believe that the family is the expert in their lives. We're there to provide support, maybe some advice, and help them with what their goals are, but they have to be the ones leading this partnership. They're the ones who know what they've been through and where they want to go. So everything that we do is very, very client-focused, client-centered. This is just a statistic that, again, I think is just, it's hard to argue. If a family is homeless and then moves into housing without case management, this is nationally, they're only 37% likely to maintain that housing. You can't just take a family who clearly has some barriers and just say, here's your house, see you later. They need that follow-up support. So in our programs that all do come with that case management, we're actually over at 90% now of families reach housing for 1 year and then usually much longer. So when you look at 37 against 90%, it shows, I think, the value of having that support system. We have 6 different programs. I won't go through each one. That would bore you to death. But they each sort of have, we have programs along a continuum. So some are 1 year long, some are 2 years long, and some are what's considered permanent housing. We try really hard to match the family with the right level of service. If somebody, only needs a little bit of security deposit assistance and will probably never touch the system again, then we're not going to put them in a permanent housing solution. So we really try to figure out what the family's strengths are, what their needs are, and then match them to the appropriate level of service. If anybody wants to know anything about those, I'm happy to answer those questions after the fact.
What's Houseability?
Houseability is a program for, again, families with children, but the adult has to have some disability, whether it's physical, mental, any sort of disability. It's a permanent housing one, so very low turnover. We have 24 slots, but because by nature it's people with a disability who probably aren't increasing their income much, it's very, very low turnover. So those spots are precious. So that would be on the higher end of the continuum. I usually highlight this one when I'm talking to congregations, because this has just been another way that the faith community has been really supportive to us. This program is probably actually my favorite. It's a 2-year program for families. A sponsor, in essence, pays the rent for 2 years. So sponsors could be a congregation or a couple of congregations together, businesses, individuals. It's not necessarily a free ride, though, for the families. The families then pay 30% of their income for rent, because that's nationally what's affordable. But since the sponsor actually pays the rent, that money that the family pays every month goes to repair their credit and pay back past landlords that they might owe or past utility bills. So at the end of those 2 years, they've now had a solid 2-year housing history. They've actually repaired their credit. they're much more housable. It's a huge impact on that family. It's a big investment, because it's about $10,000 a year to pay for that rent, so a $20,000 commitment for the sponsor. But then that impact that that it has on that family is tremendous. So I like to highlight that one. And then quickly, because this is sort of our baby. You can go to the next one. Yep. Housing and Hope. So we wanted to be a little proactive as an agency because we knew that there is a lack of affordable housing in Madison. So we underwent a capital campaign a few years ago and raised $4.5 million so that we could actually own our own housing, which has been tremendous, especially for a somewhat small agency like us. So we raised $4.5 million. Half of the money went to purchase and rehab 30 apartments. And then the other half is sitting in the Madison Community Foundation in an endowment fund. And so the money that generates from that every year is what's sort of making this rent affordable for families. So then they only have to pay 30% of their income. And it's sustainable. So these 30 units will be here as long, you know, after all of us, including me, are gone. So it's a huge thing, but a small dent in what we actually need. But it's been very successful.
Where are these located?
So the ones on the left are the first 15. They're on the north side, and then the ones on the right are on the southwest side. we had a couple non-negotiables when we were trying to find the locations. We knew it had to be on a bus line. Most of our families don't have their own vehicles. We wanted it to be close to schools, just to try to increase the likelihood that the kids would have higher attendance. Ideally close to a grocery store, so that they didn't have to go on two or three buses just to get a couple bags of groceries. Ideally, again, by a library or community center, those types of things. So we really got the good locations for what we were looking for. And then we asked some children just to kind of draw their dream home. I like to end with these. You can see how bright and cheery it is, and I think this is just sort of a constant reminder that the children, they do have hopes and dreams and goals, and it's kind of up to us to try not to let them down and try to give them what we can do. There are a couple more of these that we could just go through quickly. If you do want a little more information, this was kind of like the very 101, and we're counting it as volunteer training. This wasn't really volunteer training, though. So if you're interested in learning more, if you want to volunteer, feel free to join us for one of these tours. They last no longer than an hour, 59 minutes. They're listed on our website. They're usually Tuesdays or Wednesdays at 5:30 or 6:30. I also brought some brochures and newsletters and stuff that I put out by the coats out front. So yeah, if you're just wondering how you can get involved, we have a wish list, kind of top 10 things that we can never have enough of: diapers, wipes, laundry detergent, cleaning supplies, anything that you can't physically eat, you can't use your food stamps with. So once families are in housing, some of them are still having to pay 80 or 90% of their income for rent if they're not in one of our programs. So with the little money that they do have, we want them to pay their rent first. So anything like that we can get donated, we can get it right back out to the families. Toilet paper, paper towels, anything like that, that's coming out of their pocket. So we have that wish list item: volunteer with us or another agency. I don't care who it is, just volunteer. And then these are more pictures. You can go quickly. I do just want to point out one of them. It's coming up. I think it's hilarious. But yeah, this one's down. So look at the detail on this. You have, like, not only does it say garden, but it'll say, like, greens, peas, watermelon. You probably can't see you in the back. A three-car garage. A climbing wall in the backyard. I mean, the pool even says, like, how deep it is. You know, I mean, it's absolutely incredible. So might be a couple more, but that's about it. So hopefully you kind of got a little bit of a scope about the need, the good things that are happening, and how your support can really make a difference. So thank you very much. All right, our funding is pretty easy to remember. We're 25% government funded, and that includes federal, state, county, and city. We're 25% United Way funded. We're a very big United Way agency. They have a direct strategic plan to end family homelessness. So since that's what we do, we work very closely. And then 50% is private fundraising. Wow. So that, again, community comes from congregations, from businesses, foundations, grants, individuals. But yeah, 50% of it we're raising, and it's a $1.2 million operating budget a year. So we have to basically raise $600,000 a year. The campaign was pretty much the same. The $4.5 million, again, comes from the community. We had a lot more of like sort of the, you know, those bigger grants for a couple hundred thousand that we could apply for. And the city of Madison actually gave $600,000. So that was a big chunk of it. And then your third question of if low-income housing, is the capacity going to increase? There's sort of a new, which I wish we could talk 20 more minutes about, a new here philosophy called Housing First. Some of you might have read that. It started in New York years ago. We're finally kind of catching on board here with the idea, and even some, in fair disclosure, a lot of programs that are operating right now saying that they're housing first are more housing first. The real idea of housing first is that you take people straight off the streets into housing with no preconditions. You know, you don't have to say you have to get sober first, or you don't have to have, like, you know, it's like nothing. It's, we're going to put them into housing with the idea that once they have stability, they're going to be more likely to overcome any barrier that they have. A lot of the programs that we have here now still are saying, though, you have to do something. Like, you either have to be a Dane County resident for 2 years, or you have to complete this class first, or this and that. But the idea is catching on. I'm really excited about that. The mayor's caught on. Right now, the real focus is on ending veteran homelessness. That's huge, which is great. So hopefully then that'll, once, if when we can get that done, we'll trickle down and spend more resources on family homelessness. But right now it's on singles and veterans. It's amazing how many, it's not always women being the victim, but how many women, they don't want the police involved. They fear retaliation. They think it'll go from just getting beat up to maybe getting killed. Many women though choose between having a roof over their kids' heads, knowing that they're gonna get beat up, or being homeless. I mean, this is something it's constant. I don't have the right answer for you, but we're not gonna go call the police if they're not asking us to do that, because we don't wanna make anything worse. Cities our size, I would almost say we're middle of the pack, per se. But when you look at bigger cities like Minneapolis, New York, Portland, Seattle, they tend to be the leaders in homeless services. So I just heard a city employee give a presentation about a week or two ago, and I won't do it justice and figure everything else out. But so in Madison, we only have so much land, right? And we have a lot of restrictions. Some things can't be so tall. Some things are preserved land. Like, there's only so much space we could do. But historically, Madison always has the lowest unemployment rate in our state. It's always, you know, a top 10 city to live in. All of these things drive people in. And so we're constantly, I wish I could remember the numbers. It's something like, and don't quote me on this, but something like we build thinking that like 5,000 households a year will come in. And the last couple of years, it's been like 13,000 households are coming in. And I'm sure that those numbers aren't right, but it's something where it's like three times more are coming in, and that's why the vacancy rate then gets lower. And I mean, they're not gonna see rents going down anytime soon. They might start to stabilize. The city thinks that the vacancy rate will be at 3 or 4% in like another year or two, but landlords can still charge. I mean, it's still such a tight market that the prices will not get driven down, but we might have a little more capacity, if that answers that question. And then there's things all the time, like subtle racism still exists, which it exists nationally, but I think we're more aware now than ever. You know, you're not gonna see a for rent, no black sign, but it's amazing how many stories people come back with, and they're convinced that they weren't given that apartment or even shown that apartment because of their color of the skin. Yeah, so this is one area where Madison's definitely a leader. The Madison School District has, I guess, a little, I don't know what you would call it, I don't know, a department in the school called TEP, Transition Education Program. So they have like four or five staff social workers that are dedicated to all of the students who are homeless. So making sure that, you know, they're maybe not getting bullied. If they are, they connect them with that school social worker. Just, they have a lot more supports, whether it's just making sure that they have the right supplies. So if they're starting out school on day one, somewhat on the level playing field as their peers, whether it's supplies or that emotional support that they need. Transportation is huge. There's a federal law called McKinney-Vento, which guarantees transportation to any student who's homeless. So whether they're in a shelter or staying with family or friends, they can get a ride to school. So that TEP program is really a leader for all of the services for students. So the 5% is of students in the Madison School District, and that comes from the 1,364 that were identified last year. So they track it throughout the year, and at the end of the 2013-2014 school year, the total was 1,364. And then just because it's this week, it might be in the paper, there's something called a point in time count that happens nationally twice a year, and it's this coming Wednesday night. So all of the service providers will be literally out on the streets from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. this Wednesday to try to get the most accurate count that we could see of people who are unsheltered living outside. Yep, so the first question, given our nonprofit status, we have to be careful about lobbying per se, but we definitely advocate a lot. A lot. I'm very into policy. And the city, I should have mentioned this earlier with your question, but I don't know if people have been following the Rethke development on Rethke Avenue. So in 2016, there will be about 55 units for singles. So they're called SROs, single room occupancies. So not a family solution, but for singles. That's really right down the road. And then the year or two after that, they're actually planning to do 40 more for families. So something's working, whether it's our advocacy or just the idea that this is kind of coming up more and more across the country. But I do feel positive about what's happening in Madison now. And those will both be following more of the Housing First philosophy. And then your second question of what happens to families after 90 days, about 80% of our families who enter shelter leave successfully, which is phenomenal. And that includes ones who sometimes they literally do just up and leave, or maybe even leave town, maybe just don't want to be in shelter where there's some structure. So we have to count those as failures. I don't like that word. But so a lot of, I would say 5 to 10% are them. And then another 5 to 10% we'll work with another shelter if they haven't been there yet. So if they get in with us first and no progress is really being made, we'll try to get them into Salvation Army or the Y so that they don't have to go back anywhere else. Honestly, I've been here for 9 years, and I think maybe like 5 families total we just couldn't find a solution for them at all. So I'm pretty proud of that. I wish that I could say that no families did that, but it's very successful. Habitat, our dream is for a family to go from like shelter into one of our housing programs and then own a home through Habitat. It's amazing. And our development director actually worked at Habitat for 7 years and then went somewhere else and now is with us. And so she can say it best, but just how the continuum is so long, and our families, so many families live in poverty and don't become homeless, first of all. Like most families living in poverty don't. So when they are to the point where they're needing our services, they have like so many barriers, it's unfathomable sometimes to us. So it's gonna take a really long time for them to even get to the point where maybe they could, through Habitat, own a home. I mean, that continuum is just so long, but we're definitely always, I mean, Habitat, Valerie at Habitat and I talk probably once a month trying to figure out how we could partner better and what we could do. So it's definitely happening. I don't have a success story to share though yet. Is that it? Good. Good questions. Thank you.
I'm sure that was not it, but time-wise, that was it. Will you stay around for a few moments at least afterwards? We'd really appreciate that. Thank you for your time and for your presentation. I invite you now to get this out because we need to continue to have programs like this. We want to continue to have programs like this. Here are the closing words. If you wait until you can do everything for everybody instead of something for somebody, you'll end up not doing anything for anybody. Greet your neighbor, have coffee if you want it, and come back next week.